nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here. Now, you are sitting at the back. Can you hear me? Yes? If you can't, you have to move forward. Okay? Okay. And you're not allowed to sleep. You have to ask questions. So I am going to tell you about some work that's done in my group. It's work that we've worked on for about the last 5 years. I would like to tell you that it's work that I've done, but I have to be honest with you and tell you it's not work that I've done. It's work that was done by all these wonderful former students, postdocs, current students, and postdocs visitors in my group. I'm going to tell you something about microfluidics. I'm going to tell you actually two different stories about microfluidics. They're somewhat related. They're related in the sense that both of them involve drops. So I'm going to tell you a lot about drops, but I have to admit that none of it is as wonderful as some of the work that gets done here, but it's our small attempt in trying to understand something about drops and trying to use them. And we're going to, I'm going to tell you two different themes. The first theme is how to use the drops to make new kinds of materials, materials that you can't make otherwise. And the second theme is how to use what's inside the drops for doing some interesting applications, something that is perhaps more traditional for what you think of when you first think about microfluidics, but maybe it's a slight twist, a slight variant on what we do. So I'll tell you about both of these things. So microfluidic devices. What are microfluidics? Microfluidics, if you look in the literature, if you watch what happens in meetings, you see there's a huge amount of interest, a growing interest still, a lot of commercial potential. But in my simple-minded view, microfluidics are nothing more than the ability of controlling the mixing and flow of fluids at the length scale of interest, at the length scale that you want to control for making new kinds of structures. And once you recognize that, if you're like me and you've worked for years and years studying structured fluids, it offers a tremendous opportunity now to study things not the way you used to study them, but in a completely new and different form. And in particular, I'm going to tell you something about emulsions. Emulsions, for those of you who don't know, you actually are very familiar with emulsions. In fact, when you woke up this morning, you made a cup of coffee and you put some milk in your coffee, that milk is nothing more than an emulsion. Why is milk white? Milk is white because it contains 2% milk, for example, contains 2% by volume, small 1 micron diameter fat particles. And they're 1 micron in diameter because milk is homogenized. It's mixed really strongly to form these small particles of fat. And that's the way you normally make emulsions. And for me, who've worked all my life, or not all my life, but many, many years studying emulsions, that's the way I used to make them, is I'd mix them all up, mix oil and water together, and make drops of one kind. And then I'd work for months literally trying to purify it to get really controlled drop sizes if I want to do some really fine control over these emulsions. Well, now, today, I'm going to show you that the thing that got me excited when I first saw this with microfluidic devices, you can make the drops one by one, absolutely, utterly, perfectly controlled, perfectly reproducible, and you can start to think about using them, studying their properties, controlling their properties, and really using them in a way that you had no ability to do them before. And here's an example. This is what I'm going to tell you about for the first part, and then I'm going to show you a variety of uses. This is just a different a set of examples of showing you how uniform in size you can make these drops. The advantage of doing everything I'm going to tell you about is that you have this tremendous control, this really exquisite control over the size and shape of these drops. They're absolutely perfect. In fact, if you try to analyze them, we always quote some degree of polydispersity, but really it's to the limit of our resolution when we do it properly. You can't really even see it with these optical, just by measuring it. You know, you hope that you can see something, you quote something, but it's always probably larger than it actually is. They're really perfectly monodispersed. The disadvantage, of course, is that you are literally making them one drop at a time, and if you do a calculation of how many drops, for example, how many drops there are in a glass of milk, you see that you have to do work for a long time to get enough drops if you want to make things in bulk. But for studying them and for some uses, it's still exactly what you would like to do. So the first thing is, let me show you one way of, I want to, actually, if I go back here, I want to show you how these drops in particular were made, and these are, I want to try and control very precisely the mixing of fluids so I can make new kinds of structures using the emulsions as templates. And to do this, we actually use something that's a little different than the traditional kind of microfluidics. I'll come to the traditional kinds of microfluidics in the second half of the talk, but for this first part, we want to make something very precisely and very controlled at the micron scale. And to do that, rather than the traditional way of doing it, we wanted to do things that we could control the surface, so we wanted to do glass, and things that were three-dimensional. And you'll see in a minute why we want three dimensions. So to do that, we use, actually, as everything that we do, we try and do something very simple. So we use just capillary tubes, but we use them in the same way that the people in biology use them, people who do patch clamp measurements, for example. So you can make very finely controlled capillary tubes simply by taking a glass capillary, heating it up, and pulling it. You can make a very precisely controlled micron or submicron diameter capillary. And that's what we do, and we assemble them to make drops. And so let me show you just a schematic of how we do it. The first thing we want to do is just have a controlled flow of fluids. And so we want to have a flow of one fluid into a second fluid that's flowing in the same direction. We call this a co-flow. And for reasons that will become apparent in a few minutes, we want to have these things precisely aligned. And we use a very, very sophisticated and complicated way of aligning things. And to describe it to you in the best way possible, I refer back to a toy, at least that I had when I was a kid. Perhaps you had them. Perhaps your kids have them. What it is, it's a block of wood. And in that block of wood are a cut various shapes. There's a square shape, a rectangular shape, a circular. You're nodding your head. You remember them. You had them. So you had to put the square in the square, the rectangle in the rectangle, the triangle in the triangle, the circle in the circle. And when you're a little kid, you take the circle and you put it in the square, and it doesn't fit. Right? Not quite. It will fit if you have a square hole and you put a circle in. If the circle is exactly the same size as the square hole, it will fit and it will align perfectly. And if you use precision machine glass, this is very easy to do. It aligns perfectly. And now you can flow one fluid through the center. And because this is square, you have room on the sides to flow the second fluid. And this is a very easy way to align two capillaries to have coaxial flow and have very good and precise alignment. And this is how we align these tubes. And you'll see in a minute why we want to align them so precisely. And so we make drops, and here we are. Here's an example of making drops. This is the tip of the capillary. There's, in fact, oil is flowing this way, water is flowing this way, and you can see we're making perfectly uniform, monodispersed drops, and we're making them at a drop, roughly one drop per second, right? No. Everything I'm going to show you, and I'm going to show you a whole bunch of movies, and all of them are taken with a high-speed camera and are slowed down. So this is really making drops at several thousand drops per second, and that's a typical rate for everything I'm going to show, is making drops at thousands of drops per second. Everything will be slowed down. Nevertheless, this looks very uniform, and in fact, it's so uniform it reminds us of a dripping. Drip, 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 drip. But just as you can have dripping, if we increase the flow rate, then we can form a jet. So here's the same capillary. We're flowing it faster, and this is a jet. And now if you look carefully, and I'll hold my laser pointer as steadily as I can where the drops are formed, and you see that over the period of time, They're formed at different places in space. It's not as uniform, and if you look carefully at these drops, they're not as uniform in size as the dripping one is. We call this jetting, we call this dripping, and in fact, you should be quite familiar, particularly here, you should be quite familiar with the difference between dripping and jetting, and you know that, in fact, from when you got up again this morning and you went to the bathroom and the faucet wasn't quite completely turned off. It goes drip, 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 drip. This is a picture taken in our in the lab sink of the drip, drip, drip of our water. That's the same as the dripping. You want to see jetting? Well, it's very simple. You just flow the water just a little bit harder. And if you look carefully and you have it adjusted properly right at the bottom before it hits the sink, it actually forms jet. It forms drops, and if you don't believe me, take a garden hose and spray a garden hose, and you'll see if you spray it far enough, it always breaks up into drops. And this is jetting. And so how do we understand this? Let me go through just a very simple physical explanation of this. This is the effect of dripping, and so here what happens is that you slowly flow some water, and you form this drop. Its gravity is trying to pull it down, but it's held in place by the surface tension. And it flows very slowly. It gets larger and larger and larger. And then finally, the weight of the drop gets sufficiently large that it overcomes the forces of the surface tension around the lip, and it falls off. And it's the balance between the surface tension and the weight of the drop, in this case, that gives you uniform size drops. It's exactly the same in the microfluidics, except there it's not gravity, but it's the viscous flow of the surrounding fluid. So it's a balance of these two forces that give you very uniform drops. Jetting, on the other hand, is nothing more than if you had a cylinder of fluid. It's unstable to the formation of drops because you can reduce the total surface area by forming spheres instead of a cylinder, and so it's unstable to the formation of drops, and that's called the Rayleigh plateau instability. And we can understand something simple about the Rayleigh plateau instability just by looking at this schematic of a cylinder of fluid, and if I imagine that there's a small perturbation, a small indentation here, then the radius in this direction, the radius is smaller here than there. That leads to a Laplace pressure. The pressure is a little bit higher here, so the fluid is pushed this way, and it moves in like this. The velocity of the transverse flow, the flow in this direction, is just given by the balance of the surface tension and the viscosity, and the time that it takes is just this velocity and the radius that gives you a time, and you can just measure that time, and it breaks up into two drops in that time. Then, if in the case where you actually have a flow of a fluid, you have the same effect. Now, if you have a perturbation, velocity of the pinch off is the same, but while it's pinching off, it's actually traveling downstream. So it doesn't actually pinch off. Even though it starts here, it doesn't occur here. It goes downstream, and that gives you a jet. And the length of that jet is just the velocity of the interface times the pinch off time. This pinch off time is just given by the surface tension and the viscosity and the radius of that cylinder. So you can get the length of this jet. It just depends on that behavior. Then, of course, the transition between the dripping and jetting, you just have to ask, when does this length of the jet go to zero? Basically, what you're asking is, you need to be able to fill the drop fast enough, and it's a competition between how long it takes to fill the drop and how long it takes for it to be transported downstream. When it's exactly balanced, you get the transition between dripping and jetting. You get that transition. If you work it out, you find that in this case, it just depends on the capillary number. And when that capillary number is of order 1, you get this transition. So in fact, here is a series of different data looking for the transition between dripping and jetting, plotted as a function of this capillary number. When it's of order 1, it's here. And what we're doing is we're plotting it as a function of this different parameter. This is what we call the Weber number. The Weber number is what happens when I go to the limit of very, very low capillary numbers. How can I understand that? Here's a picture of it. What's happening here now is the flow of the outer fluid is so slow that it takes a long time for you to have enough viscous drag on the drop to actually break it up. And now you can really see what's happening. You're filling these things up. And look at this oscillation. Eventually, it causes the breakup of the jets. And in fact, you can see that the flow is inside. You can see these little colloidal particles are shooting. They're streaming down here because you're really jamming the water flow, the fluid through. You're pushing it through really rapidly. And so what's controlling it in this case is the inertia of the inner fluid or the Weber number. And in fact, this depends on the essentially the ratio of the inertia of the inner fluid to the surface tension. That's the Weber number. If you try and generalize everything, you find that it should be the combination of the capillary and Weber number. The sum of them are equal to 1. So this is the whole behavior here. Here's where the flow of the viscous drag of the outer fluid is flowing so slowly, it takes some time before the drop gets large enough. And so what you have to do is first overcome the surface tension that's holding the drop in, and you do that with the inertia of the fluid. And so, again, the transition between the jetting and the dripping is just this Weber number, and you can see here's the transition point. It's just the sum of the two equal to 1. Well, you might ask, why do I go through all of this thing besides trying to teach you just a very simple amount, the scaling. You can learn much more by the work that's being done here. But let me show you now why you might want to do this. Let me show you first a slightly different geometry for making the drops. Here's what I showed you, the co-flow, the inner fluid, the outer fluid, viscous drag makes the drops. I can do it a different way. I can take the inner fluid and flow it backwards, flow it from the other side, and force both fluids through the aperture. Here, now I'm flowing the outer fluid around like this, and the outer fluid is hydrodynamically focusing the inner fluid through the tube. This still works. It works exactly the same way. This is a flow-focusing geometry. The advantage of this is that you're focusing this inner fluid. You're making it actually smaller than the aperture itself, so you can make even smaller drops by comparison to the aperture. This works quite well. Here's an example. This is just focusing on the collection capillary. There's a fluid flowing around on the outside, curving back here, a second fluid flowing through here, and this is the dripping regime. The drops are being formed right at the orifice, and you get, again, very perfect monodispersed drops. You can do also jetting just by, you can barely see the capillary now. You can see a piece of dirt here, but there is still a capillary here. The index of refraction is so well matched that you don't see it, but you can see now you form this jet right at the orifice, and you form the drops further downstream. So this works exactly the same. This is not a co-flow, but a flow-focusing geometry, just changing the direction of the flow of the fluids. So here's this flow-focusing geometry, but what's interesting about this is now, look, you have a lot of real estate. You have a lot of room here. So let's do one step farther. Let's put a co-flow geometry on this side and a flow-focusing geometry on this side. So now what you're doing is you're flow-focusing, but you're flow-focusing a coaxial flow. You're flow-focusing a flow of two fluids here. And so now you have two possibilities of drop formation, one in this one and one on this one. And in fact, that works quite well. Here's my schematic of it, and here's an example of it. This is looking further downstream. Watch one fluid, two fluids, three fluids. Now watch carefully. You form a drop, and they retain their integrity. So now you're forming a drop inside a second drop. Well, in emulsions, this is known as a multiple emulsion. Now, I've studied multiple emulsions. Normally, when you want to make multiple emulsions, you mix up the first one. You make an emulsion of one thing, and then you take that and put it into a second fluid and mix it again. So you're making a multiple emulsion. You're making a double emulsion, and you end up with a very extremely polydispersed distribution. For example, in each drop, you end up with lots of little drops. Well, here are lots of little drops inside each big drop. You can do the same things. You just blow them up. You have a whole stream of little ones, and they're forming a whole bunch of little ones inside the big one, and then eventually the big one breaks off. There it goes. It breaks off like that. And this is, of course, well, we can now really finally control this. Here's an example. This is one of the really unique structures that we can make. This is really a double emulsion. Look carefully. You can see that there's a very thin coating, so you get this beautiful core shell structure. You can do this. I started this movie. I think this is a movie. You can get a different kind of structure. Again, a very fine core shell structure. And this, of course, tells you why I went through all this production about the difference between jetting and dripping and jetting, because now you have a large phase space. You can get the innermost fluid dripping and jetting, and get the outermost fluid dripping and jetting, and get both dripping and get both jetting. You can get combinations of them, and you can get all different kinds of structures, from this foam-like structure on the inside with many, many drops to these very nice core shell structures. You have to understand, if you want to control this, you have to understand which regime each of the drop formation is. And since you're making several different types of drops, you really have to know whether you're dripping or jetting, where you are in this phase space. What can you do with this? Well, here's a very simple thing that is really, in the end, what we had started out to try and accomplish with microfluidics, but it took us several years to get to this point. Imagine, here's just a schematic. Imagine I have this core shell structure. I have an inner fluid, I have a shell of a second fluid, and an outer fluid. Imagine that this is water, and this is water, and let me put an oil here. But in the oil, I could put a phospholipid, I could put a diblock copolymer, I could put some kind of surfactant. And let's say I make that oil slightly volatile. Then I make this core shell structure, and then I evaporate the oil. And now I'm left with this vesicular structure, a vesicle, something made just with a bilayer of surfactant, a bilayer of phospholipids, a bilayer of diblock copolymers. That's a vesicle. But in this case, the streams are completely separate. So if I want to encapsulate something inside, I can do that with perfect efficiency. If I have a very valuable drug, for example, I can encapsulate it with very high efficiency. This actually works. Here's an example of this. This is now making polymerosomes. It's making vesicle structures using diblock copolymers. The term was coined polymerosomes. It's first was created by some people at University of Pennsylvania in collaboration with some people at University of Minnesota. And here's an example, though, of making very highly controlled vesicle structures using diblock copolymers. This is the structure when we first make it. So this is a core shell structure. As the oil evaporates, you lose the index of refraction mismatch between the oil and the water, and you lose the ability to actually see it in this bright field. But if you go to phase contrast, you can still see this very perfect vesicle structure. And in fact, you can encapsulate a dye on the inside. You can see that it stays on the inside when viewed by fluorescence. If you encapsulate a dye in the shell, you can see you get a very thin shell. So you really can make a vesicle structure. But you should ask me, is this really a vesicle structure? How can I tell if this is really just a bilayer? Well, the one thing about a vesicle structure is that it should be flexible. I should be able to squeeze down. I should be able to put an osmotic pressure on the outside and collapse this shell. Well, to do that, all I have to do is add something that puts an osmotic pressure on the outside, say some salt or some glycerin. And if I do that, here's the example. I'm osmotically stressing it, and indeed, I do collapse it. In fact, if I look more carefully, I can measure the size as a function of time. It's decreasing. I can measure from this the rate of decrease. From the rate of decrease, I can measure the permeability. I can compare that with known published permeabilities for bilayers of polymerosomes. You get exactly the same value. If this were a multilayer structure, you would get a much lower permeability. So this says that at least over most of the structure, it is indeed a bilayer structure. In fact, you can look more carefully, and if you watch them as they're drying, as the oil is evaporating, you see this. You see this bilayer structure. This is really a perfect polymerosome, and the oil has come out here. It actually de-wets while it's drying, and the reason that we think it de-wets is that there's a little excess of this diblock copolymer. You don't want to have exactly the right amount. You want to have a little bit of excess. That little excess puts a depletion interaction. It puts its own osmotic pressure on the oil, and that causes de-wetting of the oil so that it forms this little drop of oil. This eventually evaporates away, and you're left with these little bumps of excess polymer on the surface of these things. So this really shows that you can make perfect bilayer structures of these polymerosomes. You don't have, you can make other kinds of structures. If you put a whole bunch of drops in and dry them out, you get this foam-like structure. You don't have to make them out of bilayers. You can make the shells and you can harden the shells. So here what I've done is I've put in the shell a region, a resin. This is a UV curable resin, and I've cured it with, by exposing it to UV. So these are actually solid shells. You can tell that by when you crush them, you get these Pac-Man-like structures that are crushed shells. So these really are solid-like shells. So you can make a lot of different structures and a lot of different possibilities. I won't show you more of this kinds of structures we can make, but I will ask just one other question. Why stop at double emulsions? Let me show you how you can go beyond that. So the first thing you do is change the geometry a little bit. Instead of making the co-flow and the flow focusing, you can use, you can put together two co-flow geometries. Here's one co-flow, here's a second co-flow, here's the first droplet, here's the second droplet, and by doing this you have much more precise control over the flow of each of them. So now you can really control, say, the number of drops. You want one drop? No, you want eight drops. You, however many drops, you just dial it up by controlling the flow of each of these things. You can control the size of them. So here's one, one, two. You're just controlling the relative size. You have perfect control of each of the sizes and the numbers just by controlling the relative flow rates. But of course, what you've done is you've just gained one after the other. Who says you have to stop at two? Why not go to three? Here's a control of three. One, two, three. One, two, three. And now you can make one, two, three. You have perfect control. These are triple emulsions. Well, double emulsions are really tough to make in a controlled fashion. Triple emulsions, I've never been able to make in all the years I've never tried to do that. But here's a perfect thing to do it. Why would you want to make a triple emulsion? Well, the reason for this is now you can start using the fluids in different ways. You can start making things to mix things. You can start making chemical reactions by using two of the fluids to make chemical reactions. For example, we used it to make a gel. Here's a particular structure that we've made. This are water drops in an oil surrounded by a thermosensitive gel, all in an oil. And we made this just to make an example of some kind of controlled release structure. Here, if we heat this up, the gel, which is protecting the water drops in this oil and keeping them from going into this gel, if we heat this up, the gel shrinks. And here's a movie of what happens. This is just heating it up slowly. It starts to shrink. It's heat. The temperature is rising. The gel is shrinking, but it's the inside is incompressible, so eventually the gel tears itself apart and spontaneously releases all of the water drops into the continuous phase oil. This is a controlled release of one fluid into a second. We can do this because we have this ultimate control of the different fluids. We can use, say, two fluids, two mixtures of fluids to react monomers and a catalyst, or monomers initiator to make the gel. We have that control by being able to control the number of drops and the size of the drops, so we can make these different kinds of structures. Okay, and so here's just a bit of a dream of what we can do with this. We haven't done this yet, but this is what really what we'd set out to do, and I think now we have the tools to do it. Imagine this triple emulsion. Imagine this being water, this being water, this being one oil, this being a second oil, but let me make both of these oils volatile, and let me put one type of phospholipid, one type of phospholipid here and a second type of phospholipid here. Then when I evaporate the oil, this phospholipid will go to the inner surface. This phospholipid will go to the outer surface, at least predominantly. And when I evaporate it, I'm going to end up with a vesicle structure, but it's going to be an asymmetric vesicle structure. The inner leaflet and the outer leaflets will be made with two different kinds of materials. This is something that, in fact, most biological vesicles are like, but it's very, very difficult to make that structure in a controlled fashion in any other way. So this is something we're working hard on. I think we have all the tools now to be able to do that. Okay, this is a sort of a brief synopsis of the kind of ability that you have to mix and match fluids to make new structures by taking advantage of the really exquisite control you have over the flow of the fluids using microfluidic devices. But really, why are microfluidics attracting such attention? They're attracting such attention because you can use them to control the fluids, to do different kinds of chemical reactions, to basically build a whole laboratory on a chip. And so there's a tremendous discussion and use of microfluidics for all kinds of high-throughput screening applications, for all kinds of applications for different types of chemistry. And there are now a number of very successful companies that are commercializing microfluidic devices. The idea is to replace what is now common in the different chemistry labs. In particular, if you want to do high throughput screening right now, you have these big robotic machines. This has made tremendous advances in trying to do combinatorial chemistry. You can ask whether they're effective or not, but certainly it's something that's been a very important development in many different parts of the chemistry industry. You can do chemistry, you can do screening, but let's just think about what really happens. What you do is you have these, so I have an example, you have these plates. These are called microtiter plates. This is not the most recent generation, but the second from most recent generation has 384 small wells on the plate, and you use them, and you basically pipette from well to well to well to do some kind of combinatorial chemistry using robotic machines to mix and match the fluids. The typical way of thinking about this is that you can do this. Smallest amount that you can use is about 10 microliters. And now it's being replaced by these microfluidic microfluidic chips. This is an example from Steve Quake, who's one of the real pioneers and leaders in this whole field. And let's just go through some of the numbers of what you can do. This is a typical screen that you might want to do with for high-throughput screening using robotics with these small microtiter plates. The smallest volume that I think you can pipette conveniently is about 10 microliters per pipette. So let's just go through some typical numbers. And this is just some sample numbers. It's not necessarily exact, but it gives you a good order of magnitude estimate. So let's say that you have a library of 100,000 components, and let's say you want to measure some concentration dependence, some binding reaction, something like that. So you might want to do 10 concentrations for each component. So now you're talking about a million different samples, a million sets of a set of reagents. If you're using 10 microliters each for each test, then you have a total of 10 liters of reagent. This is actually now a fairly significant amount of reagent, and it represents a fairly large cost. At least when I talk to some of the people who run high screening facilities at Harvard, they say they're limited by the cost of reagents that it takes to do a screen. And you can see that 10 liters of reagent is a fairly large amount. And then I made an estimate. I just say, okay, I'm doing something like this. I said it takes a few seconds per reaction. I'm just imagining a robot. And so I figure that to do this screen will take you 4 months running 24/7, and boy, that machine better not break down in the middle, or else you'll lose all that data. Okay, with current technology, like the technology that I showed you in this chip that is being sold, there the typical amount of material in each part of the microfluidic device is about 100 nanoliters. And I ask the people who make these how long it takes. They say it sort of takes an hour or something to do a whole chip. And maybe it has 10,000 wells on a chip. If I just put the number in like that, then the total amount of material is a lot less. It's a tenth of a liter. Now we're getting down to something significant, something quite reasonable. And if it takes about an hour per chip, it takes maybe a week to do all of the screen. So this is really what the promise of these microfluidic devices are. However, what you're doing is you're controlling them by having these channels where the fluid flows through. And all the fluids are flowing through the same channel. And so then you have to worry about possibility of fouling, the possibility, since you're dealing with proteins or other kinds of things, things will adsorb to the surface. Now, in principle, that doesn't matter so much, but if you have all these different compounds flowing through just a few channels, then the same or different compounds will ultimately flow through the same channel, and the fouling will actually give you some problems because you get some mixing of the different things. So you have to worry about things like fouling. So, back to what I've been talking about, back to droplets. Now, let's imagine not using these microtiter plates, not using the microfluidics in the traditional way of mixing fluids, but let's go back to droplets and imagine using each droplet as a chemical reactor. And let's see if we can do something like that. First of all, why would you want to do that? Well, in fact, in biology, this is common. Why do we have cells? Why do cells have nuclei? Why do cells have small components, vesicles inside the cell? The reason in the end is that all of biology works, in the sense all of the transmission of the information of life works by chemical reactions happening with a very, very small number of molecules. How do you get a chemical reaction to go if you have a very small number of molecules? You need, for a chemical reaction to go in a reasonable amount of time, it depends on the concentration. If you have a very small number of molecules and you want to have a high concentration, what you have to do is reduce the volume. And that's why you have this encapsulation. That's why you have the cells. And here's some simple numbers. If I take a one micron drop, a diameter drop represents a femtoliter. A 10 micron drop represents a picoliter. If I put one molecule in a femtoliter, one molecule in a 1 micron drop, that's nanomolar concentration. Nanomolar concentration for a good chemical reaction, that's sufficient to make the chemical reaction go fairly rapidly. A good enzyme will work at nanomolar concentration. And so you can start doing chemical reactions in these droplets with extremely small concentrations or extremely small number of molecules because the concentrations are reasonable because the size is so small. So a 1 micron drop becomes already a feasible thing to look at single molecule chemical reactions. The second thing is that now I showed you I can make these at thousands per second, so I have very high throughput. So you can think differently with this. Don't think parallel. Right now, the microfluidic devices are designed as an analog of microelectronic devices. Everything is done in parallels, rows and columns to have a parallel array of these things. You don't have to think them if you have things going fast enough. You can think serially, not parallel. And so if you go through the same kind of calculations now, the same calculations for the screen, if you're using drops, say I'm thinking now using a 10 micron drop, that's about a nanoliter. If you use a nanoliter drop, then the total volume of the fluid is a microliter, a minute amount of fluid. If you're doing it 1,000 per second, even allowing for a few excess to not efficient, then your 1 million set of drops, you can do it. You can go get a cup of coffee, come back 20 minutes later, and your screen is done. So this is the promise now of trying to use droplets with microfluidics as chemical reactors to control things inside the droplets. Okay, so let's say I want to achieve this. I want to make these drops as chemical reactors. What do I need to do to be able to do it? Well, here's a list. I better be able to make uniform drops. I've showed you that I can do it. I better be able to fill the drops. I might want to split the drops into two. So let's say I want to do two different assays. I can do two different assays on the same content. I need to be able to combine the drops. This turns out to be the absolute key. I need to be able to mix reactant A with reactant B, and the easiest way to do that is to have them in two different drops and mix them together. Now, this, of course, is very easy. Anybody who's ever worked with emulsions knows that the most difficult thing about emulsions is to keep them stable. So I just want to make them unstable. No problem, right? Okay, I'm going to want to be able to incubate to allow a chemical reaction to take place. I better be able to detect them. I want to be able to sort them so I know if I do some screening, I have some particular hits. This is the kind of thing that I want to do. And I want to do all of this with the real precision of microfluidics. And let me show you now that this is all feasible. So I'm going to think of these as different modules. I'm going to think that I can mix and match these things to be able to do different types of chemical reactions. Well, to do this, I don't want to use these capillary devices. They're great for making these controlled emulsions, but they're not great for making very easy different modules that I can mix and match because everything has to be assembled by hand. So for this, I go back to the more traditional way of doing microfluidics, and I'm very fortunate being at Harvard that right across the street from me is George Whitesides, who is one of the pioneers of using soft lithography to make microfluidic devices. This is actually a very important development in microfluidics. The reason for that is that before, when you made things out of glass or silicon, it actually takes quite a while to make a device. It can take weeks to months to make a device, depending on what kind of fab you use. But certainly, the idea of having an idea and going into the lab and trying it becomes much more difficult when it takes so long to make a device. In my group, we can have an idea, and the next day, we can be in the lab and trying an experiment. Of course, if you're like me, you would ask, why is it the next day? Why not the same day? So let me show you. Let me show you what the problem is. Let me show you how you do it. This is a simple lesson on how to do soft lithography. You start off with a very flat surface. You use a silicon wafer, the cheapest flat surface there is. You clean it off. Then you coat it with photoresist. Photoresist is nothing more than a polymer that polymerizes when it's exposed to UV. And so to define the channels, you expose it through to UV, but you use a mask to expose it through UV. And this mask is the culprit. This is why it takes 2 days and not 1 day, because to make this mask, we use a very, very high-tech process. We print it. We literally use a printer to print the mask. It's nothing more than a transparency with black everywhere, except some places it's clear. The thing is that we want good high resolution, so we don't go to our desktop printer. It's not really that good resolution. We go to a printing shop where they have a very high resolution printer. There used to be one in Cambridge. We would go and we take it there. They print it for us. But for reasons that we don't understand, that printer lost its ability to hold its resolution. So the easiest thing we did, we found another print shop. It happened to be in California. So we prepare the mask on a CAD program. We email it them. You get it there before 12 noon. They FedEx it back. We get it the next day. And there's why it takes 2 days and not 1 day. Because of FedEx, it takes that extra day to ship it back. But it's still very simple, so we can put up with that 1 day of delay. So here's our mask. We expose that, we polymerize the photoresist where it's clear, we wash away all the stuff that hasn't been polymerized. Now we have a relief pattern where the channels are going to be, and then soft lithography is nothing more than pouring silicon rubber, the same thing that you use to seal the windows, to seal your bathtub. You pour that silicon rubber over this, you cure it, you peel it off, and you're left with a piece of silicone rubber with the channels in it. You put in a plasma, you put an oxygen plasma to make it very water wet, and then you put against that a piece of glass that's also been cleaned in the oxygen plasma. It sticks together. You drill some holes in it, and you're left with this microfluidic device. Here's a picture of it. You can even see the 1 micron, the 5 micron pixel resolution of the printer. We typically use sizes no smaller than about 10 microns, not because we can't make them smaller. Here's an example where we've used a laser printer to make them smaller, a direct laser writer. But the beauty of having something that's 10 microns, the smallest size is 10 microns, is dust is 5 microns. And if you have 10 micron constrictions, you never get clogged by dust. Or if you do, you just increase the pressure just slightly and you clean it out. It's nothing more than laziness. You certainly can scale it down and use smaller sizes. So now let's just go through this one by one and show you that you can do each of the steps that you need to do. So the first thing you need to do is make uniform drops. Well, I've shown you can do that with the capillaries. You can do it very easily with the PDMS, the soft lithography devices. Here's a way that was first done by Steve Quake in one of his very earliest papers. It's using something called a T-junction, has the shape of a T. You have the continuous fluid phase, which in this case is always going to be an oil flowing this way, water flowing this way, and you end up with exactly the same physics. The viscous drag of the fluid, of the oil flowing by, pulls off the water drop. It's a balance between viscous forces and surface tension, and you get very uniform drops. Here's an example showing at higher magnification. These are colloidal particles inside the water. Watch not this drop, but the next drop. Watch these colloidal particles. You see the way they swirl around. That's just because of the viscous flow of the fluid, of the oil pulling on the, dragging the water and eventually breaking the drops off. Again, this is taken with a high-speed camera. The typical rate is something like several thousand per second. So you can make, doing this, you can make very uniform drops. Here's collecting them in a reservoir downstream, and you can see how uniform the drops are. You can easily control the size of the drops just by controlling the relative flow. Here the flow of the inner fluid, the water, is the same, and I'm increasing the flow of the oil, and as I increase the flow of the oil, the viscous forces are getting larger, and they pull off smaller and smaller drops until finally the drops are the size of the orifice. But when we're doing that, the oil is really whipping through. It's going very fast, and so they're widely separated, and then you get a lot more oil because you have to flow the oil so fast. So the number of drops compared to the amount of oil is fewer. You can do it differently. You can do this flow focusing geometry. This is some work that my colleague Howard Stone first did with Shelley Anna, one of his postdocs. And you can see here it's exactly the same. It's a T-junction. One channel here, a second channel here, but now there's a small orifice here. In this case, you flow oil this way, and you force the water through into this orifice, and you can make very uniform drops just using the same flow focusing geometry. Collect them downstream, you see these very uniform drops. So we can make uniform drops. What about filling them? Well, we can do that very easily. The size of these microfluidic devices are only a few tens of microns. The flow is very laminar, so it's very easy to mix several different fluids. This is actually a mixture upstream. There's three different channels, one fluid, two fluids, three fluids, and you can see they flow very uniformly. There's very little mixing except due to diffusion because of the laminar flow, and you can just control the relative rates of flow of each of these and get different concentrations of the different fluids. This one's colored, these two are clear, and they're mixed together here. So it's very easy to fill the drops with different things. The next thing you might want to do is to split the drops to allow, say, different assays. That turns out to be very easy as well. Again, you use this T-junction geometry. You have now the drops, these drops flowing this way, and as they come down and they have to go left or right, up or down, they have to go both directions. You get an extensional flow. You get a sufficient extensional flow. The drops are pulled apart and they're split into two. In this case, two equal size drops. You may not want to split them equally. You may want to split them into large and small drops. You can do that easily. All you have to do is change the hydrodynamic resistance, the length of the channels, and you get here large drops and small drops. In fact, it really does depend on the hydrodynamic resistance. This is silicone rubber. It's slightly flexible. You can actually adjust it just by pushing on it to increase the resistance of one of the channels, so you can dynamically control the size of the drops. Of course, once you can split drops in such an easy fashion, you could imagine other kinds of things. Here's an example where we start with big slugs and we break them one, two, three times, and you end up downstream with now much smaller drops starting with big slugs, and they're a much higher volume fraction. So there's lots of flexibility of what you can do just by splitting the drops. Okay, so we can split drops. What's the next thing? Well, this is the easy thing, of course, combining drops. Actually, it turns out maybe it's not quite so easy. And in fact, if you look at the history of microfluidics, you find that all the people who have gone on to start very important companies doing microfluidics started out using drops. And as far as I can tell, they couldn't really figure out how to control them and how to mix the drops. So let me show you where the problem is and what the solution is. That's why, by the way, they've gone to continuous fluid flow, which is, of course, a wonderful thing for many applications. So how do you combine drops? Well, you just shoot them at each other, and they're unstable. They're just emulsions. They should coalesce. They should break each other. So here we go. We're shooting them at each other. We're making drops up here. We're making drops up down here, and we're shooting at each shooting them at each other, but they're not coalescing. Why not? Well, remember, I said this is laminar flow. It's very uniform flow. And if you watch carefully, the flow lines of this are at the bottom of this channel. The flow lines of this are at the top of this channel. And the flow lines never meet, so the drops never actually hit. That's why they don't coalesce. Well, that's easy to solve. We just make larger droplets, and then they have to coalesce. Uh-oh. They don't. Let's look more carefully. Here's a blow-up of this. Watch carefully now. Here the two drops come together. They come together. They come together. Now they're really close to each other. This is slowed down tremendously. They're definitely going to coalesce. Come on, guys. Coalesce. Break. Come on. Break. They don't. Why not? Why not? It's lubrication. It's the same thing that makes the oil in your motor work. You have two films of fluid are coming together, and you have to squeeze the oil out enough that they actually touch. That driving a viscous fluid between the two fluids, it takes a long time. You don't have enough time. It actually turns out that it's extremely difficult to controllably coalesce two drops, even in the absence of a surfactant to stabilize them. So what do? Well, you have to add something else. What can you add? Well, you can easily incorporate an electric field to get an extra force here. The way you do that, remember I said the last step is to put a glass plate on top of the channels. Well, the glass plate you can easily pattern with some conducting material. And we use ITO or gold, different things. We can make electrodes. We can put a voltage across. We can put them at very small distances. You can easily get rather large fields across this. You can put electric fields. You can run current if you want. It's a very easy thing to incorporate that. When we do that, here's an example. Here's our two droplet generators. They're shooting drops at each other, but in this case, I've incorporated the ability to put an electric field. In fact, I can charge up each of the drops. I can charge these positively, these negatively. I can turn on the electric field. When I do that, boom, everything coalesces. Perfect coalescence, controlled coalescence. Just adding the ability of using an electric field now overcomes the problem of being able to coalesce, and I can mix drops. This is, in fact, using an electric field, so I'm using charge, so I'm actually charging the drops. That's not the ideal way. Here's a second-generation way of doing things. You don't really have to charge the drops. You can use electric field because the dielectric constant of the water is very high. The dielectric constant of the oil is very low. If I put an electric field across that and induce an electric dipole in the drops, two dipoles attract each other. So now what I do is I run two streams of drops. Notice I have large drops and small drops. The reason for that is the Poisson flow always ensures that the small drops catch up to the large drops and run along in pairs. And now I just put an electric field and induces two dipoles. The two dipoles attract and I get perfect coalescence. But now I'm not charging the drops. I'm just using the dielectric forces. So this is a very controlled way of combining drops to initiate chemical reactions. I might want to incubate drops to allow the chemical reaction to proceed, give it some time. This is one way of doing it. The picture is not so good, but you can see that I'm running drops through a very circuitous route, up and down, up and down, up and down. Turns out that's an easy way to allow a chemical reaction to occur, but I'm driving this with a constant flow, so it takes a certain pressure, and I can't make the channels too long, or it takes too much, the pressure gets too large to actually be able to push them through. So it turns out you can only have a delay of about 10 minutes on these channels, and even that's difficult, and sometimes you may want a much longer delay. But what you can do is you can put surfactant on, you can stabilize these drops, you just take them off the chip, they're just an emulsion, it's just like milk, it's stable, you can put them away, you can come back the next day if you want, the chemical reaction has taken place, and you just feed the drops back in here using the same flow focusing geometry, but rather than feeding in a continuous fluid, you just feed in an emulsion, and it works just perfectly. So the fact that you can take them off chip and then feed them back in opens up the door for doing all kinds of chemical reactions because you can just let it sit for as long as you want. Okay, so now we can incubate. What about detecting? Well, this is in PDMS. PDMS is clear. It's very easy to couple optical devices to it. You can couple a laser to it. So here, in fact, is a laser shining through, collecting the light, the backscattered light. Every time a drop goes through, there's some dye in the drop. You can detect what's there. You can set this up. You can have very good optics, and we can easily collect fluorescence from a relatively small, say 100 fluorescent molecules per drop, depending on the optics. You just have to get very good optics. So you can detect these things. What about the last thing, sorting the drops? Well, sorting the drops, I've already showed you the important criterion that you need. It's using the electric fields. You can use the electric fields to steer the drops. So here's this favorite T-junction geometry, but now the drops are going randomly left to right. Your homework problem is to decide which way the drop goes, left or right, left or right. It's a random process right now. The difference is that I've put an electric field on. I have the ability to charge the drops and then switch just the electric field so I can tell the drops, okay, guys, go to the right. Turn the electric field, they go to the right. Go to the left, they all go to the left. I just switch the electric field. I can do that very rapidly. I'm just switching an electric field, and that's what I need to sort a drop. So now I have the electric field triggered on the light that's detected right here. Any drop that doesn't light up goes up to the top. Anything that drops up, that lights up, comes to the bottom. This you can switch, you can collect the drops, you can sort the drops very accurately because you're just switching the electric field. You're not switching the, you're not switching any fluids. It's not a mechanical switch, so you can do this very rapidly. This is a more recent one. The movie is not as good, but in this case, we're not using the other one. We're actually using charge. Now we've gone to using just dielectrophoretic forces. We're using the fact that you can induce a dipole, an electric dipole in the drop, and if you put in a gradient field, that puts a force on the drop and can pull it out, so you don't have to charge the drops. You can just put an electric field. So this shows that you can sort them. Here's an example. Here we've the fact that some of the drops aren't uniform just means they coalesce when I prepared the slide to look at them. Here I'm taking drops, some of which are red, some of which are green. I'm sorting them. At the end of the sort, these are the ones that are not sorted. This is the red ones. We were sorting on the green. A few greens sneak through. These are the sorted one, and there's very, very few red that sorts through. This is our first attempt we had. We could get within 3% of perfect sorting. We can do much better now. Okay, well, there's a lot of different uses for this. I'm not going to go through this because I'm getting pretty long. This is just one of the examples of the kinds of screens that we can do. I'll skip all of this and just say one or two last small things. Remember I said I want to be able to do screening, and I really am thinking about screening large compound libraries. And the problem is that I can do everything very nicely if it's in drops, but you have to ask, how do I get that library into the device? And again, the key is don't think of microtiter plates, think of drops. So offline, you take these 100,000 compound library, and each one, one by one by one, you make an emulsion of that. But in the emulsion, you don't put just the compound, you also put some label, you put a barcode. That barcode could be a piece of DNA, and you can use some kind of PCR detection methods and sequencing to measure it, or it can be an optical label, and we have ideas of how to make a million copy optical labels that you can read. So you barcode each drop. So each compound has not only the compound but the barcode. You make all the emulsions of all of these things, and then you mix them all together. You pull them all. Remember, the drops are nanoliters to picoliters, so you can have a huge amount of drops in a very, very small quantity of material. Then when you want to do a screen, you just take an aliquot of this pooled emulsion that has, say, on average, maybe 100 to 1,000 drops per compound. And that you load into your device, and you just randomly mix, but you have them all barcoded, so as you sort them, you can also read them. So this is the way you can actually now do this really high-throughput screening, by, again, starting with an emulsion and using the ability to make very stable emulsions and load them onto the chip. One last thing that we can do is, You don't have to just have chemical compounds. What about putting individual cells in each drop? Now you can use the cell as part of an assay. For example, here we put yeast cells, and some of the yeast cells have been labeled with GFP, have been labeled with a fluorescent protein. You can see some of them are green. And this is, this is the ones that we've sorted. We've sorted on the green cells. You can see all the drops have green cells. The advantage of this is now we can make a fluorescent-aided, fluorescent-assisted cell sorting machine, a fax machine, but we can make a functional fax machine. So how you do flow cytometry, cell sorting now, is what you do is you take the cells, you hydrodynamically focus them into a stream of water, you probe them with a laser, then you break them up into drops, and you sort those drops by charging them and steering them. We can do exactly the same thing. We can put the cells into drops, but we can sort the drops later. So now we can mix something. We can incubate them. We can measure the growth rates. We can put the whole device into the incubator. All the PDMS, the oil, are all permeable to the gases, permeable to CO2, permeable to oxygen. You can put the whole device in the incubator and come back the next day and do a sort. You can add something and then do a sort. So this is a completely different way of doing cell sorting where you can add some function to it. And there's a whole bunch of things that we're trying to do with that. I won't show you what we're doing because of the running out of time. Let me just finish by saying that Darren Link was the postdoc in my group who first started this. He got excited enough that he's actually started a small company. You can look it up. He's running a small company where he's going to build devices, and I hope in about a year from now we'll be able to just buy these devices. We won't have to even build them in our lab. We can buy the devices from his company. He's actually fairly far along the way of actually being able to sell some of these devices, in case you want to do it and don't believe me that you can actually make it in your lab yourself. So with that, let me stop here. I apologize for going a little bit over, but what I've tried to do was to show you that with microfluidics now, with the exquisite control you have over mixing fluids, you can make droplets, you can use them to make new materials, and you can use the droplets themselves as very, very highly controlled microreactors for doing really high throughput screening applications, things that you haven't been able to do previously with such precision, control, and speed. Okay, thanks very much.
Environments. Have you thought about testing and validating your binding and other reaction results against the standard microtiter plates to show that maybe your results are even more faithful with regard to biological applications?
So the answer is that in some things the answer is yes, and that would be the first step. The reality is that I've showed you all of the pieces to engineer. To actually engineer all the system is something we're still working on. So we're just at the point where we're starting to, I think, be able to really do various types of screens. There's still some of the components that we're developing to do screens. The things that work now, we can start validating, and we are comparing to bulk. They work just fine. To me, what's really interesting is once you do these controls, the fact that you have this much higher throughput really means that you can start thinking qualitatively differently. If you can do in 20 minutes what normally takes 4 months, then you can start really doing combinatorial screens. And that's really what we're after.
What are the size ranges that you actually are able to
sort of
take, or how small can
you go? It's very easy to make five to 10 micron drops. To make 1 micron drops is straightforward, but you have to worry about clogging, so you have to put filters in everything. You have to filter all your solutions. We tend not to do that through sheer laziness, but you can do that. You can go up quite easily to, say, a couple hundred micron drops. So the range is between what? Microliters and femtoliters, something like that.
This is more about Professor Wayne's great
literature that for microfluidics, usually pressure-driven flow is not a desirable situation. And in your work, do you actually use something other than pressure-driven, say like electro-osmotic flow-driven type?
We don't. We use essentially pressure-driven. We control the rate rather than pressure, but you can also control the pressure. And we don't use the other kinds of flows. And the reason that we can get away with that is because we're encapsulating the drop in this carrier oil. So we're just driving the carrier oil and all the actions enclosed inside of this drop. And then pressure really works just fine. You're right that if you have a continuous fluid, then it's much easier and better to use something like electroosmotic flow or these different kinds of electric field-driven flows. But when you have the oil as the continuous phase, then pressure is really the way to go. And so then that's all we do.
Okay, so I have a question in terms of choice of compounds, say, you can screen using this technique. Because you're talking about water droplets in the oil, for example, if you have a bigger compound, which is organic, then there is a tendency that the oil will extract the compound out of the droplet. So how do you imagine that?
Very carefully. And so we do a lot of tricks. First of all, we don't use a hydrocarbon. We use a fluorocarbon oil. And most, particularly proteins and biological molecules, are not soluble in fluorocarbon. Secondly, we work very hard to have a very good surfactant. I didn't tell you about that, but we have to make our own surfactants, and we make surfactants that are basically are dye-block copolymers. One side is a fluorocarbon, the tail that sits in the oil. The second side is a fairly large PEG polymer that sits on the surface and protects the surface. We use usually a co-surfactant to get a better performance, better stability. Even then, there are times where what happens is it's not that things are soluble in the oil, but rather you form micelles, and the micelles extract the material. But I think that's a solvable problem just by appropriate choice of surfactants, and that's what we're working on very hard. There's other tricks that you can play with the oil to prevent that. So yes, that's a big problem, but I think it's solvable. And so far, for all the things that we've tried, we've been able to solve it.
So I saw very beautiful pictures and movies, and I saw coalescence. And I saw the words nanoreactors, but I did not see the product to show me, unless I missed it, something that would tell me that actually the reactions that did occur were uniform in each attempt.
Let me just see if I didn't show it to you because I think I have it here, but I skipped over it because of time. Let me just see if I have. Yeah. Okay. Here is an example of a chemical reaction. What we've done here is we've taken the gene that codes for an enzyme, and we've diluted that gene so that on average, one drop in 50 has the gene. We've translated the gene. We've added all the guts of a cell, so we've translated that gene to produce an enzyme. We've added the substrate to the enzyme, and if the enzyme acts on the substrate, it makes fluorescence. And these are the drops that are fluorescent, and on average, 1 in 50 drops is fluorescent. Now you might ask, how uniform is it? It's not uniform. But it's not uniform for a very interesting reason, and that is because there are fluctuations in the number of times the number of enzymes that are produced by the individual gene, and there's fluctuations in the number of substrate turnovers that each enzyme does. That is interesting new physics, and that's something I'd like to understand. But the ability to make uniform, to create uniform behavior in drops is well established by this. Okay, there's some other interesting physical questions there.
Is this feasible to include a solid particle in
inside the droplets can control the cell assembly of the discrete number of particles inside the compartment.
Well, I showed you that we could include cells inside the drops, and they're solid. In fact, some cells don't survive well if they're not adhered to a solid substrate. In that case, we enclose a solid particle that the cells adhere. I haven't showed you, but it's very easy to put colloidal particles inside. So the answer is yes, it's very easy to enclose solid particles. It's actually fairly easy to make the drops themselves solid by putting a gel inside and gelling them. So the answer is yes, there's tremendous flexibility.
The satellite drops.
Yes. If you looked carefully on the T-junction, the first T-junction I showed you, there were tiny little satellite drops that that were produced. But you know, they were maybe 1/10 of a percent or something, or smaller in radius, and so they're not really important.
There were also satellites we made microcapsules.
Yeah.
But they were much, much smaller.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. You know, you guys know much more than I do about the formation of satellites. And so you can tell me when we make satellites and when we don't.
One thing that's very exciting that you have to go through it fast to get to the what you want to do in the long run is the flows actually are not the low Reynolds number flows, and that's why I think they're very exciting that there's so much to study in this parameter space.
It depends. We can make Reynolds numbers that go from roughly 1/100th to 100 with the capillaries. We can get high Reynolds number, we can get low Reynolds number. We can span that distance. But yes, that's another, there's no question when I showed you that little phase diagram of Weber as a function of capillary number, that was it, those in fact were all flows where the Reynolds number was less than one. But it's quite easy to get higher Reynolds number.
For any additional questions, Professor Waite will be available at the reception in the 40 hall. So for now, let's thank our speaker.